Hey, everybody. Welcome to Politico's Off Message Podcast. I can't even say this week's because we're doing a lot of them kind of on the fly. This one is being recorded from my dining room in lovely downtown Kensington, Maryland, with my dog sitting at my feet. Just drove back from Cleveland yesterday because I don't like to fly with a couple of Politicos in tow. It took me a mere 8.5 hours, but I did get my first good night's sleep in a week. Got about 10 hours of sleep, which I think is about 1 hour more than I got in the aggregate of the 5 days that I was in Cleveland. So this week was really, really interesting for a lot of reasons. Just finished up with Trump's big speech. But to me, the big memory is going to be Ted Cruz. And we were lucky enough, obviously, to get Ted Cruz last Friday. And anyone who listened to what Ted Cruz told me, that he was watching and waiting on Donald Trump, that he had a particular vision for the country, that he cared more about that than the Republican Party and cared more about that than Donald Trump, I think would have had a pretty good idea of what was going to happen. That said, I want to tell you a little story. So Cruz drops his bombshell on the convention. He is booed out the door. His wife, Heidi, is escorted out of the Quicken Loan Center under guard because people are afraid that she might get attacked. And I decide, oh, this fiasco ends and I leave, and it's like, I don't know, midnight. I'm looking for a place to pick up an Uber. The closest hotel to the center is the Marriott. And I happen to know that the Texas delegation was hanging out at the Marriott, so I figured let's kill two birds with one stone. I'll go over there, chat with some of the people in the cowboy hats, see how what they thought of the Cruz thing, and I'll have the Uber will come quickly. Maybe there might even be a taxi there. So I get to the circle in front of the hotel. It's not exactly packed, but there are some tipsy ladies in cowboy hats, and they seem to be pretty pro-Cruz. I chat with them for a little while. I look down on my phone, and I start putting in the coordinates for Uber. I look up, and I see an SUV pull into the driveway. I don't think much of it. I keep working on my phone. I look up again, and two big guards get out of the SUV, and they open the back door. And who should pop out but Ted and Heidi Cruz? I couldn't believe it. And Cruz walks over to me, shakes my hand. And by the way, if you've never shaken Cruz's hand, it is, he tries to break at least three fingers every time you do shake his hand. And he says to me, well, I enjoyed talking with you the other week. And he said, you know, I guess I let people know what was going to happen. And then he says, what'd you think of it, generically? And I said, I thought, and I'm going to use some bad language here, I was tired and I did not edit myself. And I said, well, I thought, you know, you had some big balls in there, Senator. He said, he proceeded to say, thank you. And then he said, we're going to let the chips fall where they may. And that has proven to be pretty prophetic. But maybe the most interesting thing that happened is how much time I got with Cruz, because nobody came up to him. All of the people who were in the circle, most of them women, flocked to Heidi Cruz, and she hugged each and every one of them. And I couldn't tell if she was getting emotional, but a lot of the other people, a lot of the other women from Texas were getting emotional. It was an extraordinary moment, really, to see them offer their support to her. I think time will tell whether or not this had any lasting damage on the Trump candidacy, but it certainly starkly illustrated the divisions in the party. The big question here in terms of Cruz's own future is whether or not this big gamble, and it was a huge gamble, will propel him towards 2020 or label him forever as an insurgent willing to blow up his own party. The day after Cruz made his speech, Republicans were already talking about making Cruz Clinton bumper stickers. So it was a pretty dramatic week, and I stumbled into a little bit of history that night that really kind of made the week for me. So that brings us to our guest, Bill Kristol. I'd been wanting to talk to Bill for a while. I'm kind of a fan of his. I really like his writing. Sometimes I disagree with him. I think he's been wrong on a few things. I like the way he tweets. I just think he has an interesting perspective. And what I really wanted to know is, what was it like for the arch Trump hater, the Mr. Never Trump, to sit and watch this spectacle? And Kristol is intellectually honest enough and I think witty enough to present a pretty unvarnished opinion, both positive and negative, about Trump. And I thought this conversation was fascinating. I'll give you one little takeaway. I asked him, and he really surprised me. I asked him if he thought Trump was anti-Semitic. Obviously, Kristol is Jewish and has been very critical of some of these tweets, retweets of Trump, by Trump, of white supremacists and the whole Jewish star thing on the Hillary ad. And he told me he didn't think Trump was an anti-Semite. He just thought he was sort of thoughtless. Well, onto our regular bits of business. Please rate us on iTunes. I will omit the usual. We're doing really, really well because people, at least four or five people, walked up to me this week and made fun of me about saying how well we're doing. But we're doing pretty well. As usual, send me emails. Again, the email traffic is really picking up. A little more critical this week. Got some criticism about the Cruz interview. People thought I might have been a little too soft on him. Maybe I was. Sometimes when you get people in the news cycle, when you want them to make news, you tend to back away from your standard operating procedure. I thought it was a pretty good interview, pretty elucidating, and I think it'll hold up in terms of history. So again, send emails to me at gthrush@politico.com. Without any further ado, here is Bill Kristol. So, Bill, you knew Dan Quayle. You worked with Dan Quayle. Is Mike Pence?
I didn't. Yeah, I've got various witty comments I could make, but it won't make since I very much like and respect Dan Quayle and think he got a bum rap.
Right.
I mean, Mike Pence anyway had a good political career, a charmed political career.
And we should say that you were chief of staff to
Dan Quayle. I mean, yes. Quayle had a charmed political career as a congressman and a senator. Gets picked for VP. That's not that dissimilar, I suppose. After 12 years in Washington, obviously Pence had the additional 4 years as governor. But the Quayle rollout was kind of botched, and he wasn't quite ready for it, whereas I think Mike Pence actually had expected it for a little while at least, and they've done a pretty competent job of introducing him, I think.
How do you compare Quayle spoke with one of our reporters, Darren Samuelson, and gave Pence a pretty stirring endorsement. I mean, what do you think of Pence in terms of what he brings to the brings to Trump? And
I mean, I just think what I look, I worked for Dan Quayle when he was vice president. I wasn't in the 88 campaign. I watched it with kind of horror, somewhat close up. I'd come to Washington 3 years before to work in the second term of the Reagan administration. And what I learned from not watching Quayle's, unfortunately, bad performance in 88, and I think we had a decent performance in 92. Quayle held his own in the debate with Al Gore, et cetera, is that vice presidents don't matter much. Bush won by, I think, 9 points in 88 after this, with Quayle being ridiculed widely, and we lost by 7 points in 92 with Quayle being, right. I think, at least among some, being thought, the ridicule was unfair, and he did well in the debate. He was a good vice president, did well in the debate with Gore. So vice presidents are kind of overrated, which I do think, though, if I can at least do a broader point, which is, I mean, we're all interested in the convention day to day, and it has been a clown show so far, honestly. And I underestimated him throughout the primaries, obviously, and I don't want him to be president of the United States, so I'm happy to make the case against him. But analytically, just looking at this election, I don't know. If I were in Hillary Clinton's campaign, I would be worried. She's up like 5 points over Trump, who's made all these mistakes.
Right.
And he has more room to grow, I think, because he could reassure people if he runs a semi-intelligent, semi-normal campaign, whereas what's she going to do? I mean, there's no reintroduction of Hillary Clinton that could possibly be made at this point, I think.
I don't know. I think there is. Again, you're talking about I think there won't be because I think she's too damn cautious, right? I think you could potentially have something of a rebranding and move the dial a little bit if she chose, for instance, to get out of the penthouse suite and actually talk to people, which she doesn't do. So I think, and Matt, our mutual friend Maggie Haberman and I about 18 months ago did a story talking about Hillary's complete antipathy towards the press, and I think it's entirely self-destructive. I mean,
is it true she hasn't had a press conference this whole campaign, right?
That's right. She has not had a press conference since, I believe, Seinfeld was on the air. and the last one she had was, I'm misremembering this, but the Guernica press conference, I think, was...
Yeah, that was a highlight.
I would generally say, if you're giving a press conference, try to keep away from the iconic massacre paintings of the 20th century, right?
Now,
that's a good... You did that with Quayle, I thought, brilliantly.
Thank you. I'm really the right person. I'm the right person to talk to about managing media, appearances, and not avoiding spelling bees where you...
Good idea. But let's get back to...
Let's get off the good old days with Dan Quayle,
okay.
Right?
So
he got a bum rap. He's a good guy.
In terms of the Reagan speechwriter who's working for Trump, now you're a words guy.
I think, but just trying to step back and be analytical and kind of cold-blooded, I think his problem is he's got all the supporters who want to be more enthusiastic about it. He's got to reassure wavering Republicans, independents who occasionally vote Republican, that he's it's okay to be for him. He'll be pretty responsible. That you can get, here's what, if I were advising him politically, I would say, what you want is to preserve the distinctive brand, you know, the excitement, the outsiderism, the willing to tell it like it is and all that. But you also need to reassure people that you actually could be president of the United States. It's, if you want to think of it in casino terms, I guess, or whatever, you can have the glitziest casino in the world. That's great. The most exciting, crazy entertainers and all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, this still has to, the shower has to work. The room has to function. The casino, the right. poker games have to be honest. I mean, he needs to kind of take, the first he's taken care of. There's no need for more glitz, more drama, more all that. So I guess I do think he needs to reassure people. Maybe that's just me being too conventional. Maybe I don't get it. Maybe Trump just ride that populist kind of demagogic horse all the way to the White House. And maybe he could. I kind of hope not. So if I were advising him, I would say, and this is kind of conventional, I think, you've got to tone it down a little, emphasize maybe the kinds of advisors who will be around you. Give people who are dubious about you an excuse to come over. So I do think the thing he has going for him that I think, and maybe I'm, again, too scarred by 92 to go back to the Bush-Quayle years. Right. In a change year, being the candidate of change is a huge advantage. Voters will want to overlook their overcome their concerns about the change candidate, because they do want change. You know right. what I mean? They want, if you can give them an excuse to vote for you, Clinton and Gore did this in 92, people forget how unbelievably big the question marks around Clinton were, but before, as he staggered to the Democratic nomination.
And look at the numbers per row.
Right. So people, right. if people can just, but they want to be for change. This is Hillary Clinton's biggest problem, I think. She is, more than any other American could be, the candidate of the status quo, I would right. say the embodiment of the status quo, in a year where people want change. And so if I were Trump, I would say, you got the aggressive change vote. You need to get the vote of people who think, is that Trump change? Is that just a little too risky? So what I would do, but this is not his style, is talk about some kind of more normal, conventional types whom he has been consulting and looks forward to consulting, respected foreign policy figures, generals, admirals, businessmen or whatever. So people sort of get the sense that, he's kind of a loudmouth and says some outrageous things and is a troublemaker. But at the end of the day, it'll be kind of grown-ups surrounding him. I think that would be important for him to do. And I do think he'd be well advised to semi-apologize for some of the things he said. And he could get, the bar for him is so low. People like me wouldn't forgive him, but I think a lot of people out there would want to forgive him.
And
the way to do it would just be to say, look,
it was a tough primary.
I accept this presidential nominee. And I've thought a lot about this. This is the presidency of the United States. And I've had a colorful career. I'm a colorful guy, say what I think, blah, blah, blah. But, I probably said a few things I shouldn't have said. And now that it's a presidential race, I'm going to comport myself as a president of the United States. And you know what? I can make some jokes. I may disappoint a few of you by not, by cutting back a little on the tweets, but I think that would go a long way. The media would give him credit. Certainly Republicans who want to believe right. in him would give him credit. Whether he would do anything that acknowledges that everything he's done hasn't been perfect, I don't know.
Well, the other thing that I would do if I were him is that, and has there ever been a more pundity preface. But what I would do if I were him is the classic Reagan and Clinton thing, which is I would identify five Americans not named without the surname of Trump to talk about, people that he quote unquote met out on the campaign trail who symbolize the problems of the country. What have you ever heard Donald Trump invoke an experience he had with a normal person?
That's a good point. I would do the same. And I think with Glenn Thrush and Bill Kristol giving him this advice, he's quite unlikely to take it. And you know what? He's done pretty well. Maybe he's right not to take it.
That's right.
But I also was struck by the kids' talks. I mean, they were pretty generic. I mean, it was better than what people expected because the bar is so low. But I mean,
It was good airplane food.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right, but shouldn't there be some anecdote? Maybe they didn't spend much time with him, honestly. So, I mean, I don't know. But, some story that reveals. I mean, that's kind of traditional for these speeches, right?
I'll never forget the time Dad picked up his own towel.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'd say the featuring of the kid. Now, I could be wrong. Or maybe we're just in reality TV political mode now in this country, and what people want to see is, hey, the family, hey, the kids look nice, hey, we like that, that's exciting, the wife, the third wife, the kids, I mean, maybe that's where we are, and I'm just out of touch. I'm certainly willing to acknowledge that to some degree, but I wouldn't have gone so heavy family. I don't think Donald Trump What does he get out of?
But what's your move? There was no other move last night after you had the first night was the first night was literally like watching an Auschwitz documentary. It was death. It was the most depressing 4 hours. I mean, I went.
I agree with that, but I don't agree with it quite that. That's a little extreme. But
not Auschwitz, maybe.
But I mean, it needn't have.
Dachau.
Couldn't he have set up the first two nights? I mean, it's supposed to be national security and the economy. Right. Those aren't crazy themes.
Right.
Have a boring, bunch of foreign policy types. I mean, he had some people there who are credible people, Mike Mukasey, the former attorney general. Right. Just let them give a semi-serious critique of Obama's exceeded the law, the executive orders, the rule of law, the Constitution. Is it a stretch to think that Donald Trump cares at all about those things? Yes. Would a normal swingish Republican voter in the suburbs of Northern Virginia think, you know what, if Mike Mukasey says he's pretty confident that Trump, for all the talk, would kind of go in that direction, maybe I'd be okay with it. But that's not their theory. Their theory is it's reality TV. The one thing we know about reality TV is people, once they see the main guy, they want to see the wife, the kids, the uncles, the aunts, and that's what the convention has been like so far, which makes me think he won't take you're on my advice for Thursday night, shockingly enough. But.
Well, let me bust your chops on something. So you had a candidate in Dan Quayle, and I'm not going to litigate a 25-year-old case here, but, geez, it's more than 25 years, close to 30 years. Dan Quayle was a candidate who was not perceived, rightly or wrongly, Bill, as having an enormous amount of intellectual heft. But he was surrounded, as was Reagan, by a core of serious policy people and genuine public intellectuals, right? That has been the model of kind of a quote-unquote not the brain surgeon candidate for years and years and years. The difference between, it seems to me, the thing that almost personally offends you about this guy is that he has chosen to de-intellectualize the presidency, that he is somebody who does not surround himself by people who are of the highest caliber. Talk a little bit about that. This is a guy... am I right to point that out?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. I hope it's not just a matter of like my being aesthetically displeased or my vanity being hurt because I work for Dan Quayle and whatever. I think, look, it meant whatever you think of George W. Bush, to take a more recent example where I think people thought he was lightweight. But if you think of it, it showed a certain seriousness about becoming president of the United States, especially when he had no foreign policy experience of his own, to surround himself with Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Dick Cheney, et cetera. People can say it didn't work out. It shows the limits of that, and maybe that's a fair point at some level. They fight with each other, and having Rumsfeld and Powell, battle the entire first term might not have been the best way to run foreign policy. Still, I think he got a certain amount of deserved credit for that. It showed that he took the job seriously. Yeah, so one of the things I don't like about Trump, among others, is that he doesn't seem to even think that that's an appropriate thing to acknowledge. But at the end of the day, it does come down to the person himself. And I do think in that respect, people can say what they want about Quayle, about Bush, about others in both sides, really, who, had limitations and flaws. But none of them had this kind of cavalier attitude. None of them said the things Trump has said. And what does that show? I mean, I think they didn't think some of those things. But B, they also thought, geez, I'm running for president of the United States, or in Quayle's case, vice president, and I can't just pop off in ways that, that Trump has. It's just bad for the country, really. You can't say that a judge who happens to be issued one ruling that was somewhat unfavorable in a civil case is a Mexican or is representing the interests of Mexicans, whatever that would mean, because I guess his parents had come from Mexico. I mean, that's kind of not what you do in America. You don't attack personally denigrate your competitors with these kinds of adjectives in the way he does. That's never, I would almost say that's, we've had very tough politics the last 20, 25 years, the Clinton impeachment and so forth, attacks on Bush. It's almost never been, but nothing quite like what Trump has done. It's certainly not by the candidate themselves. Whatever you think, Barack Obama, McCain, I mean, there was nothing like this. And
but how important, how
I think that's bad for the country. That is really third world politics. You don't just make the policy case. You don't even make a character case, which I think is
how
kind
do you
of
put
legitimate.
That, Gene?
You make a kind of pure denigration of the guy or woman you're running against.
But it's obviously we're having a lowest common denominator effect. And I think it's making the entire atmosphere toxic in a way that we haven't seen in previous campaigns. Look, I think, say what you want about Hillary Clinton. I've covered her for a really long time. The woman's tendency is not to go ad hominem. Her tendency is to stand up there and read a laundry list of policy prescriptions.
I think the Clintons bear some responsibility for this, for the way they attacked some of their critics in 98, they had people, they had surrogates. But it is interesting that they had surrogates, which tells you something already. It's one thing to have your Sid Blumenthal's out there.
Right.
It's nothing to do it as the candidate. And And it is different because it really does denigrate the presidency, I think, in a way that, yeah, I totally agree. I think we are in, this is one reason people like me are, you know, sort of upset and unhappy about this election. It's not just, I don't happen to like this personal guy, this guy, or I don't agree, he disagrees, I disagree with him on more issues than I would normally disagree with a Republican nominee. It is, I think, a whole different level of just political discourse and political activity, and it's not good for the country.
Is there a market for positivity? Now we talked about, like, because that's the issue. We've known this about negative ads. You know, I'll never forget when I was first covering politics, it's like I asked some consultant, maybe this was in a mayoral race, like, why don't you run a positive ad? And they're like, because it doesn't work, right?
Right.
Is there a market? We saw in 2008 there was a market for positivity at a time when the country was really going into the dumper. But is there right now, do you think, a place for positivity?
Yeah, we don't know because it hasn't been tried that much, I suppose. I'm not sure there isn't, actually. And I do think the kind of independent candidates, the people like we were talking about, if they had run, would have run positive campaigns, would have tested the proposition that people are a little sick of all the negative attacks. And again, but I sort of distinguish between they're tough and somewhat unfair negative issue attacks, right? You blow up something that's kind of small and make it, that would be the attacks on Romney, perhaps. They're tough and somewhat unfair, negative, even personal attacks. Mitt Romney, you know, fired X number of people or whatever. Right. But we're at a level beyond that. I think that was people in 88, people remembered the attacks on Dukakis as being, whoa, that's really a tough, and it worked.
When you look at it now.
Yeah, really? I mean, he did actually veto a bill, you know, on the Pledge of Allegiance. He did actually have a furlough program that he defended.
Well, Willie
Horton. Now, was it a little dramatic to highlight one person?
The Willie Horton thing, I think, even in this context, was over the top. I mean, him riding around in a tank, that was fair game.
But it was actually a Massachusetts, you know, policy that he had put in place that had resulted in this terrible rape and by this convict. Now, you know, that I think is the traditional way in which in a democracy politics gets somewhat demagogued and flaws get exaggerated and people get blamed in ways that aren't entirely fair. But that's still a whole different level from Lion Ted and Crooked Hillary and the kind of stuff that Trump just routinely does. And that I think is kind of third world politics where you, and unfortunately, and this I do think is Paul Manafort, who is basically running the Trump campaign. I joke about it a little bit on Twitter and stuff, but it's not a joke. It's not an accident that this guy worked for all these authoritarians abroad. That's his image of politics. He relished crushing the never Trump forces. It's a little crazy, isn't it? You want unity. You want these people to support you, presumably.
Right.
And yet his image, of course, is intimidation. And intimidation works, incidentally. And this is another sad thing that, again, it's always happened. God knows we had Mayor Daley. We had all kinds of bosses.
Yeah.
There's always been behind the scenes, you might say, intimidation, but never quite as overt as today.
Oh, we had it with you. I can identify several figures. I will say, if you kind of read T. Harry Williams' biography of Huey Long, you know, Trump gets compared to Wallace. Wallace was a very reactive, in a lot of ways, limber politician in a way that Trump isn't. I would say the analog was the man who spoke two nights ago, who I ran into last night, Rudy Giuliani. I think the way Giuliani, I have always viewed I view everything through the prism of New York City politics, but it really does seem New York City politics, tabloid politics, has gone national, right? And Rudy's denigration of his critics, and you can go back on the lineage and look at Ed Koch. Koch did it in sort of a softer, more humorous way. But I think Trump learned a lot from Rudy and Koch.
Well, he is from New York, and there probably is, maybe you're right, that in a certain way, I guess I'd probably defend Rudy more than you, but let me put it this way. Look, you've always had demagogues. You've always had celebrity politics. You've had the Jesse Venturas. Those have typically succeeded at the local or state level.
Right.
And we've always had people who don't care about issues and are just kind of ridiculous, sort of blowhard minor celebrity types. They tend to get elected to Congress or Senate.
Right.
And I just think it's very different for the political system when a certain percentage of those people flourish at the local or state level, or some percentage of your congressmen are sort of bozos, but you know, or characters.
Well, Mencken would talk about how like Congress is.
That's just different from the presidency. And whatever you think, and this sounds so earnest and kind of good government, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but nonetheless, I will say it. You know, whatever you think of the people who run for president for the last, at least for my adult lifetime, and I would go back actually before that quite a bit, and maybe go back all the way, frankly. They've all been respectable people. And they were serious people, certainly on the Republican side.
Right.
the people I voted for ever since 72, I mean, Nixon's a complicated case, but, you know, he's a very impressive man in many ways, and former vice president for 8 years and all that. And in my case, the first time I voted for him was 72, so president, incumbent president. And after that, you've got Ford, Reagan, Bush, Dole, Bush, McCain, Romney. You know, whatever, again, limited. Some of them were not great candidates. You could criticize some of them on policy. But, you know, they are serious people. And I would say on the Democratic side, the same thing. Obama, yes. Clinton, Kerry, you know, go back to Dukakis, Mondale, you know.
Serious
and,
people.
Yeah. And that really, in that respect, Trump really is something new for us. He's common in some other Democratic systems. I think it's one way we've always viewed ourselves as a little bit exceptional, if you want, or superior to these other systems. We tend to have managed to keep the demagogues cabined at the state or local level. Huey Long was shot. We don't know if he might have succeeded in 36 in becoming more of a national demagogue. Wallace was a regional demagogue, taking advantage of, you know, a particular moment on the most fraught topic in American politics race. But in 72, one interesting question is, if George Wallace had not been shot in 1972, you know, people forget he was like, it was not crazy that he would have been competitive for the Democratic nomination.
Well, he was
nomination.
Also different.
But he was different. I also agree with that. It was so.
Wallace was actually, you know, I mean, I think the characteristic that Trump has, and I'm not diagnosing him here, I think it's just a statement of fact, is there's a level of narcissism to this guy that is sui generis. I've never seen, usually, I mean, Wallace could work a crowd. You know, I covered the very tail end of Wallace when I was a reporter down in Alabama, right?
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, not when he was in office, but when he was dying, you know?
Right.
And this was a guy who could really interact with people and had that thing where he was remembering the faces in the crowd. I don't think Donald Trump gives a shit about the faces in the crowd. He just sees the crowd, right?
Yeah, and it's all about him. And again, we can laugh about that a little bit. And God knows politicians are narcissistic and always have been, and egomaniacs and all. But they sort of suppressed it. And they, at least for prudential, you know, for reasons of success, had to pretend to be interested in other people and at least had to figure out how to work other people. I mean, Trump is shrewd in that way, I suppose. He does seem to, you know, when he meets people, he can sort of read them, I suppose, and take advantage of their weaknesses. But it's all about him. I mean, these stories that I think are totally true, and I've heard one or two, you know, off the record that confirm them, that Trump, when he talks to Paul Ryan, when he talks to interviewed some of these vice presidential candidates, he thinks he doesn't want to deal with policy.
Right.
And again, I'm not being overly earnest. He doesn't have to know the details of different versions of Medicare reform, but does he have to have some sense that we have an entitlement problem and that these are the alternative ways of dealing with it? You'd think a normal presidential candidate
has no intellectual curiosity about any of this stuff. And I actually think, having covered the White House, I happen to think that you are actually, it's ironic to me that he's regarded as somebody who's portraying strength, because that's a recipe for having a staff-controlled president. Somebody who doesn't have any, you know, we had Roger Stone on here, it's got to be 2 months ago. And Stone, very overtly said, this is not a guy who's going to read a briefing book. Everything has to be presented to him verbally, and you got 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think he reads almost nothing. So I'll tell one story. I'm not sure I've told this publicly. Yeah. So at the very beginning, he announced, was it July, I think? And I was wrong about a lot of things in this cycle. I guess a lot of us were. But on this, I was right at the beginning that he might do better than people thought and was saying a few things that the other candidates were neglecting. So the first editorial I wrote, I think it was the first one, people can go check, after he announced, was sort of, you know what? I said at the very beginning, Donald Trump is at the bottom of the list of, I was after, you know, of candidates that the Weekly Standard would ever consider supporting, him and Rand Paul at that point. Not that we actually do support people editorially, but I said, you know, my colleagues and I probably won't vote for him. He's at the very bottom of the list. But here are three or four issues he raised in his announcement speech that are worth the other candidates paying attention to. And then for about a week, 2 weeks, it wasn't more than that, I think, I was not defending Trump, but I was sort of trying to make this case of taking him seriously. I think on that I was correct. And so it was sort of portrayed as being a little bit anti-Trump. I mean, sort of saying to the people who were right away, just saying the guy's ludicrous, pathetic, ridiculous, disgusting. So, yeah, but wait, just wait, be a little more cautious. I don't think I went much further than that in, quote, defending Trump. And certainly, so I'll tell the story. So I'm in the office on Friday. I remember that it was, I think, early August. He had announced in mid-late July. So it was 2 or 3 weeks after he had announced. It was the phone rings and my assistant gets it. And someone who says she's Donald Trump's assistant is on the phone and says, Donald Trump wants to talk with you. And of course, I assume it's like a joke, one of my, you know, Steve Hayes or John McCormick or someone causing trouble. But, you know, of course, who knows? And anyway, so what if I take it? It's a joke. So I said, yeah, we'll put it through. This woman comes on and says, please hold for Mr. Trump. And then there he is calling me from his plane about to take off, which is clever because he sort of had a good excuse to get off at about 3 minutes. Right. So, hey, Bill, good to talk to you. I said, hey, how are you? He said, hey, thanks a lot for what you've been... I love your magazine. And they tell me it's really great. He said something that revealed, I don't remember, I don't have photographic recall of this a year later, but he said something which at the time I remember laughing at to myself about and talking to my colleagues about, which revealed that of course he didn't know.
I love your restaurant, I hear you have coffee.
Yeah, right. Read the Weekly Standard, but someone had told him, the Crystal edits this magazine and you should say that, you know, it's a good magazine, whatever. Mm-hmm. And, but he did had seen me on TV a couple of times, that's his medium. And I had been sort of warning against underestimating Trump. I said, hey, look, I know how it came out. He said, they told me you said you'd never really vote for me, but I'm gonna persuade you otherwise, Bill. But anyway, I appreciate you, at least on TV, you're saying that, you know, people should listen to me and take me seriously and you're fair. I really appreciate the fair, I always like fair-mindedness, you know, blah, blah. We'll have to get together sometime. Hey, got to hang up, got to take off for Iowa. And the reason I remember this is he then, it was like 4 or 5 in the Friday afternoon, I believe he then took off for Iowa. The next day was the day he made the comment about McCain, John McCain, and the POW. The next day after that, I was sort of randomly on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, which I do every 2 or 3 weeks, but I mean, this happened to be a week I was on. And I think Martha Raddatz was guest hosting, and she asked me about it, and I said, well, he's dead to me. I can't. And of course, I stupidly said, I think this is just going to kill him. I mean, you can't defend the proposition to Republican voters that you have contempt for POWs because they got shot down. And of course, I was totally wrong. Why did I go into this long riff? I can't remember anymore because...
The point was, I think... let me get back to the anecdote. So did you get a word in edgewise?
A few, but it was mostly he had his 2 minutes of, you know, flattering me sort of and telling me I was going to vote for him.
Did you want to tell him? I mean, was there any moment there where did you want to tell him anything?
Not really. And I didn't want to make it seem like if he listened to me on one or two things, I would then vote for him. Because I just thought at the time, as I've thought throughout, that he's not qualified or really fit to be president. So that's why I had written that in that first editorial and why I've stuck to that throughout. So I didn't want to be in the business of kind of giving him advice.
But by the way,
it was such a fast conversation, I probably didn't have much of a chance to anyways.
And his taco salad, I think, was getting cold. But yeah, right. I think the interesting thing is I've been privy to some of the polling of some of the anti-Trump groups over the months. And one of the McCain thing didn't really register that much with people. What did register with people was his denigrating Serge Kovalevsky, the Times reporter who has the disability. That one, by a factor of 2 in some of these focus groups, offends people, is what I think.
And I think the Clinton campaign's using that quite prominently in their early advertising. I guess the reason I brought up this story is it was that he doesn't read it. I mean, just the funny thing about, hey, they tell me you wrote this in the Weekly Standard. I mean, it was an 800-word editorial. I'm not at all, like, offended he didn't read it or anything like that. It just was kind of funny that they didn't, I think they literally didn't give him
the
one-page thing to read. They sort of orally told him. Crystal says he's some, you know, they'll never vote for you, but he does say you should be taken seriously. You know, call him and try to keep him on board.
And I would say you're a zippy read.
Which, like, I know. Read your stuff. And again, it's not at all. This is not at all vanity or anything like that. I was just amused by it, but I think it confirms what I've been since told by other people, which is he really doesn't read anything.
No, you're correct.
He listens. He's just. He's a smart guy. I don't buy the argument that he's at all dumb or anything like that. He's a high IQ guy, I think. He listens. He's a quick study. He picks up stuff. He watches TV. He learns, as he himself said, didn't he, from the shows. But that's the level. But the notion that to be president of the United States, and again, I don't mean to be overly earnest. Right. You don't have the 8-hour briefing on the internal dynamics of Erdogan's party in Turkey and all that. That's what assistant secretaries of state are for, you know. But
why should you understand the regional?
But you should know something. Right? I mean, like, Turkey is a NATO, you know,
and we have
like,
we might have a base there.
Yes, now that kind of that level of understanding and the basic choices you have to make
are the Atlas missiles still there?
Is important to to have, but he doesn't think so. And you know what? Maybe he'll Maybe we'll now experiment with having a president who doesn't think any of that's important.
Now I'm going to bring the hammer down on you. You do have an enormous an enormous knowledge of world affairs, and George W. Bush surrounded himself with people who were arguably some of the best informed people of the past half century on this stuff, and they made what appears in historical retrospect to be a pretty significant error in judgment. Now, My theory of now you can take your notes.
Yeah, reminding myself like disagree with disagree with Thresh's overconfident assertion that it was an error. But anyway,
Thresh,
I'll just stipulate that we may disagree on this. But I'll take your point. Okay,
all right, go ahead. But in general,
My theory of the case is that in a weird way, Iraq was, I think, like the financial crisis to a certain extent, in a lot of ways created some of the deepest internal divisions on the Democratic side. But I think Iraq had a Nixonian impact on the Republican Party, and then it shattered faith. I think the Iraq decision shattered faith in the core assertion that there was an establishment that knew what it was doing. You obviously were part of that process. So, Bill, isn't all this shit your fault?
Yeah. Life is complicated. I totally agree, and I believe I've written myself the core point you're making about both parties, and I would just say it's a bipartisan thing.
Yeah.
The combination of the foreign policy mistakes of the Bush administration, I would argue, is not having enough troops there first and sticking with Rumsfeld's strategy, but let's just leave that aside. The difficulties of Iraq, the failure to find the WMD, which, of course, destroyed confidence in the intelligence agencies, combined with the 07-08 crisis, where the experts said this can't happen again. They know what they're doing. Right. Alan Greenspan, he's spreading risk brilliantly among, by chopping these mortgages up into 37 bits. I mean, I do believe those had a huge effect on the country as a whole, on both parties. Now, what was weird about, and I wrote in 08, I think that was the one year I wrote that column for the New York Times, the ill-fated weekly column for the New York Times. But I believe I made the point in the New York Times that, the public is not wrong to be suspicious of experts. What have experts gotten right over the last decade or two? They've been wrong a lot. And maybe a healthy suspicion, a healthy populist revolt, I've always been sympathetic to. Now, I think it was weird what that happened over the next 8 years. I kind of expected it to happen more quickly.
But that's
always the way it is. And there were little signs
of
it. You think the delay. I mean, the delay is sort of the weird thing, though. Yeah. So for example, my first column for the New York Times, January 08, was a semi-defense of Mike Huckabee, of all people. I did it purposely sort of to make New York Times readers like, wow, yeah, what's going on? But what was the contempt for Huckabee? Leave aside liberals who just didn't agree with him on anything, but among like the Wall Street Journal Republicans.
Yeah.
It was that Huckabee had this critique of Wall Street. Wall Street is not doing well for the country, and the whole thing is dangerous. He wasn't very sophisticated. I don't think he understood exactly how the crisis was going to play out. Who did, I suppose. But I remember semi-defending Huckabee's semi-populism, you might say, on the Republican side, being said, you're crazy. This is terrible stuff. We can ignore this. And then in 2012, I was much more sympathetic to Santorum. Not so much on the social issues, actually, but on the kind of working class populism
He was a real trailblazer.
They were both
on this
precursors.
Stuff.
They were Trump without the celebrity stuff, and with, in each case, I would say, too much of the old-fashioned social conservatism that limited their appeal.
And too little talent, really.
And probably, yeah. And so, but they were precursors, and I agree with that. And on the liberal side, obviously, Sanders is the effect of all of this. And I very much agree that, so it's, of course, it's complicated. So one has sympathy with the revolt against the experts. But as I always say, it's fine. I mean, I have sympathy with the revolt, but sometimes you can correctly disdain the experts and embrace a set of policies that are even worse than the experts' policies. So that, the fact that the experts get everything wrong don't mean that you then get everything right. And you can get them even more wrong. And I would argue that's the case with a lot of Trump's economic being. It is right to say dogmatic, orthodox embrace of pure free trade is probably does not take account of the complexity of the world we live in. We've published that in a million pieces, making that argument in the Weekly Standard. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that protectionism would be good for America or for the world, right?
But let me push you on foreign policy, because I think on the Republican side, it has more to do with Iraq, because look at the last really unified Republican convention. McCain was unified, and so was Romney to a certain extent, but the last of those big-time conventions was in 04, and it was really the Republicans were the war party, and there was a great deal of unity post 9/11. And the Iraq experience shattered that coalition, don't you think?
I don't know. Yes and no. So on the one hand, I thought it might. I mean, of course, analytically, you would expect that to happen after a tough war.
Right.
But actually, the Ron Paul, Rand Paul stuff didn't. I mean, I think it was a big flop, basically.
Right.
I mean, at this time, if we were having this 2 or 3 years ago, the conventional wisdom, and here again, I was right, I think, was Rand Paul is going to be the exciting new flavor of 2015,
absolutely.
16. And I said, I don't think so. Because I think the party, and this here Obama, in a weird way, helped restore a kind of, okay, we might not want to get into the details of Iraq, but being tougher is better, and withdrawing was a mistake, and not intervening in Syria led to 400,000 deaths or whatever. So, again, fairly or unfairly, just saying analytically, in a way, the Republicans were able to kind of coalesce around a critique of Obama's foreign policy. I don't know how much of Trump's, I would be duped, if Trump said, how much of Trump's appeal is for being a critic of Iraq? versus being a critic of free trade and the immigration issue. I would say Iraq's number three, but maybe that's my own wishful
thinking. I think Iraq is the...
I think immigration was the big one. And we were going, and the establishment's going with the Gang of Eight bill, and the RNC saying we have to have be liberal on immigration was really set Trump up. And then having Jeb Bush, think about it for a minute, Jeb Bush, liberal on immigration, Marco Rubio, liberal on immigration, is the two main kind of establishment alternatives to Trump, really helped Trump. And I do think trade, which I've always minimized as an issue, is big.
Huge.
I don't think it's analytically huge. That is, I think, honestly,
if we had
pursued different trade policies, the effect on America, on Ohio, on manufacturing jobs would have been small. Nothing, but really small in the big picture of things.
Right.
But it has become the emblem, the symbol, whatever the right word is, for elite, you know, friendly policies being
screwing
followed
regular,
in a mindless way. And screwing regular kind of working class, middle class. See, I think that I underestimated.
I think of the immigration thing as an extension of kind of the natural kind of aggressiveness of the Republican Party, usually manifested in the modern time by kind of a strong military. Because I think the great paradox of Trump, and you've illustrated this, is this guy talks incredibly tough and has a very Obamian.
Right.
Like a very Obamian approach to the kind of actual commitments he wants to make.
Right.
That's the fascinating thing. It's like, what we need to do is start talking like Reagan, but continue with an Obama foreign policy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know. Again, I don't know how important that is. If he had more of a McCainish foreign policy, would it have changed his appeal much? I think if he had combined, I think the anti-immigration stuff was huge. The trade stuff was huge.
Right.
And being strong, I agree, the Fortress America type of strong, or America First type of, quote, strength, is probably fits in better with those other policies than a McCain-Bush-like aggressive internationalism, because that does imply, as Bush to his credit saw, and he doesn't get enough credit for this, that if you're going to try to help liberal Democrats around the world, you're going to have to do nation building, a term that no one will embrace anymore, and you're going to have a Petraeus-like attitude towards winning people over. And, you know, and Bush to his credit went down that road. Now he's mocked for it both on the right and the left, but actually he did see that you couldn't just, as Rumsfeld wanted to do, go in, depose Saddam, and leave. But it turned that was difficult.
Well, as my friend,
it wasn't implemented very well, and now we're in a sort of Rumsfeldian. I mean, I'd say in that respect, Trump is more Rumsfeldian, which is ironic for me because it's the most failed, in my view. It's sort of the worst of all worlds. You know, be very aggressive, but then don't be serious about following up on aggressive.
Well, because then you get into a situation where you make a promise and eventually you have to deliver on that promise, and that's what really creates a difficult situation. But let me ask you something.
Yeah.
You mentioned 72 is the first time you voted for.
It was my first presidential election.
It was your first presidential election. Your family, when you go back to your dad, you know, I don't know. I guess I know the Podhoretz story, the parallel Podhoretz story more than yours. But your dad, was your dad kind of the red diaper baby that moved in the conservative direction?
He invented the term neoconservative, so he did in a way. But I'd say he was a liberal. He was an anti-con. I mean, he was Trotskyist, a very young man at City College, and then a socialist.
By the way,
I
will tell you flat out, I am a part of my family is the Bronsteins, and I think I'm a linear descendant of Leon Trotsky.
Well, I can see the resemblance. No, Trotsky was a handsome man.
That's why I'll never
don't take that wrong.
Thank you. I will never go to Mexico.
Wise. But he fought in the war as an enlisted guy, and I think that destroyed any of his illusions about communism or socialism. And so he was a liberal anti-communist from the war 45 on through the 50s and 60s, and always a critic of more conventional progressive liberalism. So it's a bit of a myth that he invented the phrase neoconservative as a liberal who's been mugged by reality.
He voted for Roosevelt, right?
He may have been too young, but yeah, I would have, I think.
Yeah,
I voted for Truman. And so in 19, and but he was never as much of an orthodox liberal, as I'm saying, or certainly a left liberal, as some of the other people who became neoconservatives. It was always a streak of, he read a lot of people who are now thought to be kind of neoconservative authors as a young man, was respectful of religion. Anyway, so slightly unorthodox, but anyway, you can read his essays from the 40s and 50s and 60s, they're quite good. But in 68, he wrote a piece for the New Republic, making the case for Humphrey. Now, it was a case for Humphrey against Kennedy and McCarthy, I think Kennedy may still have been alive at that point in 68 during the campaign, but also, of course, preferred Humphrey to Nixon. So that's where sort of the anti-communist liberals were then. And 72, he was one of those people who I think signed a newspaper thing saying, right, you know, I think we need to be for Nixon over McGovern. So in that respect, yes, he's...
And it was very New York, by the way. What people don't really understand is New York had the creation, and you know this history as well, the Hardings and the Liberal Party were created by anti-communist Jews,
right,
who were tired of having... Jewish liberals perceived as being Reds. I mean, there was
some of them were Reds. I mean, that's why they had to create their own party and break from the progressives. So anyway, So he, by 72, he supported Nixon, and then the neoconservatives moved into the Reagan coalition. Really, Gene Kirkpatrick was a very close friend, and that kind of thing. After the failed last gasp of that kind of liberalism, I would say.
But here's a question I want to run by you. You are on most social issues, you would describe yourself as being moderate, right?
Yeah, moderately conservative. I'd say I was more conservative than a lot of the neoconservatives who remained liberal.
Are you pro-choice, generally
speaking?
No,
I've always been pro-life.
You've always been pro-life. How do you stand on civil unions and gay marriage?
I accept it. I was more of a defender of traditional marriage. We recently published things in the Weekly Standard on that side of things. I don't think it was a good court decision, but I also think, you know what? I mean, it's not my business. I get one vote out of 330 million, and I think it could be a great country with same-sex marriage. I'm not worried about it.
Right. And you are you're broadly a supply-sider?
Yeah. I think Reagan's type of economic reforms were good for the country and good for the world. And again, this is one of the things that annoys me. If I can take a second on this.
Yeah.
That most annoys me about Trump and the reaction to Trump. Trump doesn't annoy me. Trump is Trump. You know what I mean? He's a demagogue. He's whatever he is. It's the reaction to Trump, the accommodation of Trump, the normalization of Trump by so many Republicans and conservatives that does annoy me. He was right about one thing, the weakness of the Republican establishment. And you can see it on display this week as everyone sort of accommodates, not to say grovels, to him. But what it has led to, incidentally, is a non-defense of some traditional Republican and conservative policies that are worth defending. And they were too simple. They weren't perfect. You can't go back to 1980. I understand all of that. But at the end of the day, the basic defense of markets against what people forget was a very powerful democratic socialist, movement worldwide. The fact that China and India went in a market direction, in my opinion, lifted hundreds of millions, probably billions of people.
It's
a historic achievement.
We're in the middle of what people
the greatest
do,
moral.
It is the most unbelievable. It's the problem
that
it's happening
due,
outside of our
and
borders.
And it's due to, and even in America, I mean, there's been six. Progress over 40 years. And a lot of that's due to markets. And again, in a non-dogmatic way, it doesn't mean you have to have perfect free trade. And a lot of that is due to an American-maintained world order, which has basically meant there have been no wars in East Asia in the last 40 years, for the first 40-year segment in modern history. And it's meant that people could get about, improving their lives. And again, conservatives should defend that. That's a genuine achievement, I would say. And Trump, of course, attacks it all or is...
But let me
oblivious to it, and conservatives are much too much now, in my opinion. Say, you're right. That was sort of simple-minded in American leadership in the world and free markets.
Let me keep going down my laundry list here for a second, because I have a point to make, which is if you sort of look at kind of a Kissingerian, a rationalist sort of foreign policy in kind of an asymmetrical environment, somebody who really understands that's what you're about projection of power in a pretty significant way. Why is it, now you have huge disagreements with Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama on market stuff, and you think that obviously that Obama's foreign policy wasn't robust enough in the red lines and whatnot, but Hillary Clinton is a much more interventionist, she's a classic liberal interventionist, right? She argued for Libya. To some extent, isn't she are you and folks like you moving more in her direction generally?
I think I'm probably closer to Hillary Clinton than to Donald Trump on foreign policy, and maybe trade for that matter, though her party has a lot of problems with free trade. I'm closer to, who knows what a Trump administration would be. I'm probably closer to the Republicans who would staff a Trump administration on a heck of a lot of domestic policies, which are important policies for the future of the country, ranging from Supreme Court appointments to kind of identity politics gone amok and various other things. So if it were a domestic policy election, I probably would swallow hard and vote for Trump. If it were a pure foreign policy election, I'd probably swallow hard and vote for Hillary Clinton. But since the president has a lot to do with foreign and domestic policy both, I, for now, at least think I still would like there to be a third choice. But anyway, I really don't would prefer not to. And also, I think the ethical issues with Hillary Clinton are more of a problem.
What are you going to do?
Kaine, if Tim Kaine were the Democratic nominee, or I don't know, any generic, yeah. you know, I don't know, like a loop or something, you know,
but
generic
you could vote
Democrat.
For, if Tim Kaine were, who actually yeah, fits so your profile, you'd vote for Tim Kaine?
I would probably vote for Tim Kaine over.
But you're not going to vote for Hillary?
I don't think so.
Is this an election where you may
but
not?
I also want to say, and I yeah. really am never Trump and never Hillary, and I don't want to, but having said all that, you can say never Trump, never Hillary, all you want, but in the, as a real citizen in a real democracy, one would have to look up around October 20th and say, well, what have we learned anything that has changed? Have you learned anything that's changed your mind over the campaign? I don't expect to.
But you are still persuadable on some level.
Well, I think one has to be, just because, again, in the real world, I mean, not that one vote's going to matter or what I say is going to matter, but, you know, you'd want to sort of try to be responsible, and maybe stuff will happen over the next 3 months that really will change my opinion, either about Clinton or Trump. I think that's unlikely, or more likely perhaps about the urgency of some set of issues. I mean, look, if Trump, you know, that's why his speech Thursday night is important, and not for me, but because there are voters out there.
Right.
If he sounds like, let's say, John Bolton, I'm not quite where John Bolton is on foreign policy, right. but, you know, hard-headed realist, shouldn't intervene in Libya and stuff right. like that, but still basically an aspect, at least, of the Reagan tradition, that'll be one thing. If Trump sounds like Pat Buchanan, that's another, you know, and right. therefore, I don't, leaving me aside, I think there's some chunk. Obviously, this is kind of a maybe chunk of a sort of kind of a, of an elite, you might say, but probably one that has some ramifications throughout the country. I'd say in the military, for example, and other people who are interested in America's role in the world. It would make a big difference if he sounds more like John Bolton or more like Pat Buchanan Thursday night.
Put the percentage. What's the percentage that Bill Kristol votes for Donald Trump ultimately?
I think very low, very, very low. Because for me, that is character.
So what do you do?
At the end of the day, the President of the United States is, I mean, that just is commander-in-chief. So I might not vote. I don't really, I'm not very moved by the, oh, you've got to vote. It's your right. civic. No, it's a free country. America, unlike some other countries, does not have mandatory voting. And one way to say what you want to say is not to vote for the presidency and vote down ballot. And that's a way of voting, too.
Well, I'll dismount on an incredibly light note. And that is, do you think the guy's an anti-Semite?
No, not in the normal sense that he has some wakes up every morning thinking that, you know, I wish the Jews weren't around or stuff. I don't think it's pretty hard to be a successful New York businessman for 50 years and have that. And there's just not much evidence of that in his actual life. And obviously his daughter's now a practicing Jew. I think he is extremely tolerant of very bad types, both on anti-Semitism and on racism and bigotry in general.
Right.
And I think that's itself a kind of carelessness, to use a term that's been used recently about Hillary Clinton, but I would use it for Trump, a kind of carelessness that, again, we've tended to hold presidents to somewhat higher standards. And when they have it, incidentally, when Obama, when everyone discovered Jeremiah Wright and the sermons and all that, President Obama, maybe it was disingenuous, it was political, I understand that, had to give a major speech saying, look, on that aspect of my pastor, I can't defend him and I won't defend him. That's not unimportant. It may have been, as I say, my conservative friends all thought, hey, can you believe he's getting away with just making one speech and that erases 10 years of going to the church? Well, that's a fair point to make.
Right.
But still, he gave the speech. He gave the speech.
I think it was.
Donald Trump has not given that speech.
You think he needs to?
I think it would be better for the country if he did, yeah.
The I love the Jews speech. I got to be honest with you. I'm a little surprised. I thought you would have leaned in a little bit harder on this. This guy has retweeted time and time again stuff from white supremacist groups that the Jewish star thing. Come on, man. You know.
No, I know. Well, that's terrible. I agree with that. Yeah.
I am right now in the position of trying to goad Bill Kristol into calling Donald
Trump.
I don't
know. I'm so annoyed by the overuse of that term in a way, and the lack of serious sort of gradations between a kind of tolerance of, you know, of stuff that shouldn't be tolerated, as opposed to actually going around trying to kill Jews or destroy the state of Israel. That I guess
I lied. There was one last thing. So you are. My sense is that you are, over the last couple of days, walking around. You've been wearing Groucho glasses and a mustache, walking around the streets of Cleveland.
It's fantastic. That's right. It really works well, those disguises. Yeah, yeah.
It is my sense, I have heard through the grapevine that you're starting to feel a little nervous. You've had conversations with some regular Americans, which I know is difficult for you.
Can you believe the abuse here I am, and the abuse I take?
How are you feeling right
just
now?
Just trying to bolster your liberal credentials by going out on a harsh note.
Hey,
yes.
Watch it, kid. How are you feeling in terms of, who do you think is going to win at this point?
I'd say two things, though, about the disguise. Actually, people have been very nice, and I think mostly because people are nice and Republicans are polite, maybe. And also, there's a lot of anti-Trump sentiment on the convention floor, I mean, and among Republican types. And most of them, unlike me, are, we got to get along, we got unity, we're going to rationalize this. But they're not happy about where they are. I think that's really a very big undercurrent at this convention. Who's going to win? I mean, I have the conventional view that Hillary Clinton is more likely than not to win. She's been ahead, and Democrats have won the last five of the last six popular votes, and it would seem unlikely that Trump, with everything, with his massive negatives, is going to be the guy to turn that around. But I am a little, I guess I would, if I had to lean against the conventional wisdom on this, I would say that he has more of a chance than people think. I do think there's probably some hidden vote, kind of a Brexit kind of thing. And I'll tell one quick story. I went to lunch Monday with a couple of younger colleagues, and it was for a restaurant, right, a hamburger place joint. A nice waitress, chatting with her, mid late 20s, has two little kids apparently. She's taking them to Disney World at the end of the week. It was discussing that, just joking about that, talking about that. She'd never been before. Kind of working class, lower middle class background, clearly, and working hard as a waitress, seemed like an admirable young woman. And after chatting a little more, one of my colleagues said, "Well, do you mind if we ask who you're going to vote for?" And she sort of hesitated and said, "Well, don't tell too many people around here, but I'm going to vote for Trump." And one of my colleagues said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, I got a couple of, I think generally so tougher. I don't like Hillary Clinton, but also I've got a couple of relatives who are cops, policemen, highway patrol, whatever, and I don't like what's happening with respect to the police, and I think Trump would be tougher on all of that." And I said, I couldn't quite tell her age, and she struck me as maybe someone who isn't a regular voter. So I just was curious. And I said, "Well, have you voted for president before?" And she said, "Yeah, I voted for Obama twice."
Wow.
I mean, how many, if that's a non-trivial swath of the country, that would be a big moment. I mean, she's not a social conservative, God knows. She has these two little kids that didn't seem to be a husband in the picture. She's a young person. I'm sure she found Obama much more congenial than John McCain, who was her grandparents' age, or Mitt Romney, who was almost her grandparents' age. And if someone if some non-trivial chunk of voters are moving over to Trump away from Obama, also the type, I bet, if she got a phone call at home, A, she probably doesn't have a landline, and B, she probably is not telling pollsters she's for Trump, but she thinks it's kind of politically incorrect. And final point on that, I mean, this is a young woman, and isn't Hillary Clinton supposed to be first woman president? I mean, the degree to which that appeal, which I think we were all taking kind of seriously as an analytical thing 6, 8, 9 months ago, seems to have totally collapsed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Maybe not. I mean, I don't know either.
I think we're focusing so much on Cleveland. I think this year, the order of the conventions has never been more important. I think the fact that the Democrats get the last word is a big, big deal this year.
It puts a lot of pressure on them, though.
Yeah. Well, listen, Bill, it was a blast. Great talking to you.
Good talking to you, Glenn.